death penalty cases in Florida thrown into limbo after a ruling by the Supreme Court. We'll explain coming right up. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening on this chilly Tuesday. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a nice weekend over the holiday. The show's always live at 9. And now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we will take your calls on Florida's death penalty limbo. As the Supreme Court says, the state's sentencing system for death penalty cases is unconstitutional. Where does that leave so many cases, including one high-profile case right here in Jacksonville affecting the Farah family? Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Also this morning, Generation W founder Donna Orender on a citywide day of service for women and men, too. We'll tell you all about Generation Works. Plus, it's our book club today with two titles to talk about and a special event. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a rash of death penalty cases across the state of Florida have been thrown into chaos after a ruling last week by the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court struck down Florida's death penalty sentencing system, declaring that it violates defendants' Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury. Now, that means delays for the outcome of so many cases, including several here in our area. About 400 people currently sit on Florida's death row, and quite a high percentage of them come from our 4th Judicial Circuit. It makes up Duval, Clay, and Nassau counties. In fact, Duval County ranks 8th in the country for administering the death penalty. One death row inmate in that group was convicted in the 2013 murder of Shelby Farah of Jacksonville. 2 years ago, defendant James Xavier Rhodes offered to plead guilty to the murder in exchange for life in prison without parole. Shelby's mother, Darlene Farah, urged the state attorney's office to take that plea. However, state attorney Angela Corey says she still intends to pursue the death penalty for Rhodes. This morning, we begin the hour with a closer look at that case and what the Supreme Court ruling means for the death penalty in Florida as a whole. Darlene Farah joins us now in studio with her thoughts. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Also in studio, we have attorney and former prosecutor Dale Carson. He's co-counsel on the civil suit with the Farah family's case and is also legal and criminal justice analyst for Action News. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa.
And on the phone, Ben Jones, campaign strategist for Equal Justice USA, a criminal justice reform organization. Hi, Ben.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. The Supreme Court has ruled Florida's death penalty sentencing system unconstitutional. Where do you stand on the death penalty, and what are your thoughts about what this means for Florida's death penalty cases? Get on the line now, 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect, email and tweet us, or you can just weigh in on Facebook. So, Darlene, let's begin with you. You tragically lost your daughter, Shelby, a few years ago, and it's so sorry. We're all so sorry about that. Can you begin by telling us why you've decided to speak out about this death penalty situation in Florida? Unlike some family members who've lost loved ones, you don't support the death penalty for your daughter's killer. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And why is that?
I never believed in the death penalty. I've always raised my kids, two wrongs don't make a right. And I never could understand how they can seek the death penalty in cases where somebody's already murdered somebody when killing them is not bringing the victim back.
Now, in the case of James Xavier Rhodes, he has asked for life in prison without parole. In the murder of your daughter, Shelby.
With no appeals and no parole. But I do want to clarify, he hasn't been convicted yet.
He hasn't gone to trial yet.
No, ma'am.
Is that right? State Attorney Angela Corey is pursuing the death penalty in this case.
Yes, ma'am.
So that means more delays for your family to see resolution, which is really your concern, right?
Yes, ma'am. I have two other children. My son, his senior year, he only needed 2 credits. He quit school. He can't even focus. He's so angry. And then I have a daughter that graduates this year, the same month that we're supposed to go to trial. And it's just, I mean, the grades have dropped. It's just a struggle. With everything that we're going through the court proceedings, I feel like I didn't just lose one child. I feel like I lost all three of my children.
Dale Carson, you are co-counsel on the civil suit in this case. Not only is the Farah family's case thrown into limbo, this ruling, the case at the high court was called Hearst versus Florida. This ruling throws into legal limbo cases across the state. What can we expect going forward?
Well, it's not their convictions that it throws into limbo. The convictions will stand. It's simply that the jurors must unanimously decide in the sentencing procedure that follows the conviction that the individual ought to be executed. And absent that, this case is, at least as it stands today, have to be revisited. It is a bit of a problem when we think about it, because jurors who agreed that someone should be put to death during the sentencing phase were told that the judge was going to make the ultimate decision. So, of course, you might be inclined to say, oh, what the heck, I'll just agree with the death penalty, even though in my heart I don't. And so this could lead to further ramifications as the Florida Supreme Court begins to set up the procedures and policies that must be followed by the trial courts in moving through the sentencing phase of these death penalty cases.
549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment on the Supreme Court's ruling striking down the constitutionality of the death penalty system in Florida. Ben Jones, State Attorney Angela Corey, issued this statement the other day in response to a call to halt all death penalty cases in this judicial circuit. She said, "The death penalty is still a viable sentence in the state of Florida. We will follow the law and in appropriate cases seek the death penalty. This opinion deals with procedural issues, which will be addressed by the Florida Supreme Court and the legislature." What about that?
Well, ultimately—
Oh, and I'm sorry, Ben Jones.
Thank you. Well, I think what you see in the Hearst decision is a microcosm of what you've seen with the death penalty over the last decades. There is so much uncertainty and delay that characterize the system. And, you know, there will be attempts to try to fix it, but what you find in death penalty cases across the country is that it takes years, often decades, for an execution to be carried out. And even if And in many cases, the death sentence is overturned and you go through all this long process for nothing. And you, because of this process and how painful it can be, you see many people speaking out against things, including murder victims' family members.
Darlene Farah, your family's story and many others is profiled in a new documentary film that will be released later this year. It's called The Penalty, and it looks at the death penalty in America. Let's take a listen to the trailer.
This is an emotional issue with strong feelings on both sides.
To actually make this decision is extraordinary.
A lot of people don't realize what families go through. It's a lot.
My family is kind of falling apart. He hurt a lot of people by taking one life.
If I would have saw him that night, I would have killed him.
I spent 15 years on death row in the bloodiest prison in the country.
Now, we're kicked out into a world where, well, what the hell am I going to do?
We're looking at a...
So in this film, your story is told.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you had a chance to see the movie yet?
No, ma'am.
What are your thoughts about that, about your story going coast to coast? It's a painful, traumatic experience to have gone through, you know, your family going through this, and it will be revisited. Did you feel it was worth it?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah?
People need to know what families go through. I mean, at first I thought it was a joke. When he contacted me the day after I went public with not wanting the death penalty. And like I said, at first I thought it was a joke, but it's real. I mean, but people need to know. A lot of people don't realize. I never realized it. You know, what families go through as far as death penalty cases. It's a lot different.
And that goes for families that are pursuing the death penalty for their loved ones as well.
Yes, ma'am.
Sure.
And excuse me, Will, the person doing the documentary, said that he's met a lot of families that wanted the death penalty, and then as time went on, they didn't want it anymore because of everything they've gone through. You know, they were going through at the time.
Dale Carson, let's talk a little bit about this circuit. The majority of death row inmates in Florida, well, not the majority, but a high percentage come from this circuit. And Angela Corey has made no bones about that, saying she follows the law and she aggressively pursues the death penalty in these capital cases. In light of this ruling, do you see that trajectory changing at all?
You know, I really don't. I've lived here off and on all my life, and clearly the crime rate has increased over the decades. And there is a Southern tradition of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And I think that that has severe implications here, particularly with the death penalty. And as you'll remember, it used to be, and I've been involved in law enforcement since the early 70s, that a victim had to want to prosecute a case. I mean, it wasn't unusual for a victim of a robbery or a burglary or any sort of case to simply say, you know, I'm not interested in pursuing that case, and the state would drop the case. The state in the last decades has really overreached its bounds and said, no. The state will prosecute this case, and if you don't want to prosecute it, that's too bad. We have an interest in protecting, in this case, someone who's dead.
Let's go to your calls now. As the Supreme Court throws out Florida's death penalty system, what are your thoughts and questions? 549-2937. Don is on the south side. Hi, Don. Good morning.
Good morning. Wonderful, wonderful topic. I just recently served as a foreman on a jury with on a robbery case that involved a weapon. The weapon wasn't used, but what strikes me is that this was my first time on a jury, and we had to come up with for three counts basically, and the evidence that was presented both from the defense and the prosecution was very limited, I thought. There were witnesses and all of that, but we could only convict on the fact that the timelines, that's how we came up with our consensus, and we did find a guilty verdict on all three counts. But it was amazing to me. It's not like the O.J. Simpson case. It's not like, you know, what you see on TV. It's very limited in the information you're given as a juror, and you have to come up with a consensus. And my feeling is that, being that the case, I don't know how a jury could. I'm not sure I believe in the death penalty just because it can be so abused. So I'd like your comments on that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Don. Let's go to Ben Jones. Ben.
That's one of the reasons there's so much concern over Florida's death penalty, is the way that it's currently set up is the jury only makes the recommendation, and it doesn't even have to be unanimous. And what studies have found is that when you don't need that unanimous finding, there may not be as much deliberation, and, you know, people may reach a decision more hastily than really we desire. And I think a lot of people are concerned that with this current process in place, too many mistakes are being made. And in fact, Florida leads the nation in the number of death row exonerations, so that is cause for concern.
Now, Dale, there are five death penalty trials scheduled between now and the first week in April in our circuit, including that very high-profile case resulting in the death of a little girl named Cherish Periwinkle. So this is something that the legal community will be watching very closely.
Well, absolutely. And this Florida Supreme Court will promulgate the rules and the requirements to match up with what the federal Supreme Court has in mind. And I don't see that there'll be any particularly large delays. And in these cases, in any event, they are extremely delayed. And that's what Darlene's concern is. They've been waiting 2 years for some closure on this so they can move ahead with their lives. And I'm being corrected. It's two and a half years. Right.
You would just like resolution in this, Darlene. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. It's been 2 years since he put the offer on the table. Tomorrow makes 2.5 years we've been dealing with it.
Let's go now to Lewis on the South Side. Hi, Lewis. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. First and foremost, my condolences to the Farrah family.
Thank you.
I do understand what she... her convictions about death penalty. My only issue with the whole thing is that our jail system is supposed to be rehabilitation. It just doesn't happen. I just feel like the whole system is broken. And the only solution that we have for people with no rehabilitation prospects would be the death penalty. I just don't know. You know, shy of that, how can, you know, somebody like Periwinkle or anybody else that is on death row can be rehabilitated?
Thanks, Lewis. Thank you. Darlene.
I just want to say in our situation, the defendant was awarded to the state. I do want everybody to know I'm not feeling sorry for him. But what I'm fighting for is what's, I feel, right, because he was awarded to the state and grew up in a boys' home. The state created him. So how can they kill him? He was adopted when he was 15, and it was not a positive environment, and then he went to jail at 15 and a half.
What would you say to those listening who disagree and feel that someone who, regardless of their circumstances or their disadvantages, that they still should face the ultimate punishment if they take a life? You just don't agree.
I mean, who are we to put a date on somebody's life? Only God can.
Let's go to Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom.
Ah, yes. Good morning. My opinion right now on this issue is that the death penalty in itself needs to go because it's a horrible, outmoded measure of a court system that's for the most part broken and needs to be reformed, and that needs to be the first step. Let's get rid of the death penalty, which has always been applied in a very random and discriminatory way, and reform the system so that we do, like Lewis suggested, start reforming the prisoners, the convicted, so that they might return to society.
Thanks, Tom. Ben, let's talk about the application of the death penalty nationwide. It is on the decline.
That's correct. We saw in this most recent year, 2015, executions were down, death sentences were down. In the past decade, 7 states have taken steps to get rid of the death penalty. So, and also you see it reflected in public opinion over the past 2 decades. Support for the death penalty has dropped around 20 percentage points. So, as a nation, there's definitely a strong shift away from capital punishment, and more people are asking, is this really the best public policy?
As you said, though, Dale Carson, a strong cultural tradition in this pocket of Florida, change on this issue is not something that you expect in the short term.
No, it is not. And I think there's a strong history of executions for people who have engaged in the antisocial behavior that comes with the killing of another human being or other things that deserve the death penalty. But I don't see any particular change coming quickly. Of course, one of the concerns is that if there's a mistake made and someone's paid the ultimate price, how do you reset that equation? And the answer is you can't. So do we warehouse people in forever to keep them away from the rest of us, or do we try to rehabilitate them? And rehabilitation costs money.
Darlene Farah, as you wait for some sort of movement, what are your final thoughts and your thoughts that you'd like people to know about your daughter, Shelby?
I think the whole community knew Shelby. She was very well loved. We volunteered a lot in the community. She gave up cheering for the Jaguars to coach the less fortunate kids. And Shelby wouldn't want the death penalty. Shelby didn't believe in the death penalty. I mean, we have to honor her legacy and keep her memory alive.
Well, we thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll continue to follow this story as the legal procedures move forward around the state. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
We were joined by local mother Darlene Farah, attorney Dale Carson. He's a legal and criminal justice analyst for Action News, and Ben Jones of Equal Justice USA on the line this morning as Florida's death penalty sentencing system is ruled unconstitutional. We'll follow that here on the program throughout this year. And much more still ahead later in the hour, our book club. Also, why the elephants are retiring from the circus, how that will change things, but not the protests coming to town. But up next, spotlighting Generation Works, a citywide day of service, a conversation with founder Donna Orender. That's in a moment.
When it comes to redeveloping downtown Jacksonville, the best laid plans have often turned sour because of spiraling costs or problems with infrastructure. But despite setbacks, the city has made strides in recent years. In Community Thread Downtown Developing, we talk with the movers and shakers who are transforming downtown and meet others who say challenges still remain. Log on to wjct.org/events/community-thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be part of our studio audience on February 11th.
Working on an oil rig is great when a barrel goes for $100 a pop, but now that prices are dropping, what's your exit strategy?
We're saving up for a nice piece of property with trees and a river, and once that's paid off, we'll go home and we'll eke out an existence at $15 an hour and be happy.
I'm Molly Wood, financial advice for life after the oil fields. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Bobcat pelts are one of the most valuable and coveted wildlife products.
If it was all the way to the ground with the full sweep in the hood, could be $150,000.
We want this black and white, you know, like the Cruella de Vil, where she was all about the white with the black spots, you know, the Dalmatians. Same thing with the bobcats.
The beauty and cruelty of fur on the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, how a group of wealthy conservatives changed American politics. We talk with journalist Jane Mayer. Her new book, Dark Money, offers eye-opening revelations about the family of industrialists Charles and David Koch and tracks a network of think tanks, nonprofits, and political committees that spent hundreds of millions on a libertarian agenda. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Well, for the second year in a row, hundreds of women all around Jacksonville and the men in their lives will wield weapons of mass construction to make a difference, inspire others, and connect with each other. It's all coming up on February 6th at Generation Works. That's Generation W's second annual citywide day of service. Donna Orender, the founder of Generation W and Generation Works, joins us now with a preview. Good morning. It's so good to see you.
Oh, it's so great to see you, and it's great to talk about this. I'm gonna go with the lead. February 6th.
That's right.
7 a.m. at Unity Plaza. If you recall last year.
I was there. I was a little late, which I felt really bad about. I will not be late this time.
As one of our ambassadors, I mean, this year we're so proud to have Molly Curry, our first lady.
Yes,
and Eden Kendall, who hosts River City Live.
She'll be at the big kickoff, of course.
And Ironetta Wright, who's the regional superintendent over Duval Transformation Region, because we do a lot of work with the schools in the Transformation Zone, which is really exciting, you know, redoing their atriums and their play in their gardens and stuff like that. It's just so exciting and it's so gratifying.
And this is something you dreamed up as a follow-on to Generation W, which is the annual women's leadership event that you created every spring. What this is, you've gotten women together all over the city to put together service projects, and there are all kinds of projects to improve this entire area. It's a brilliant idea.
Well, you give me so much credit. I didn't dream this up. It really was a reaction. You know, listen, this is a great community of women, and so many women come from all over the country, and we have Generation W on April 8th this year. But women keep saying, we want to do more. We want to do more. I think we're crazy. I think our plates are so full. But the request kept coming in, and I said, well, then, listen, let's put it all, if we want to make a difference, let's come together. There's the spirit of camaraderie, right? There's the joy in each other's company, but it's more than that. Right? A vibrant, great city is about the talent in its city. And there are so many women doing great things. And I think that the more we can recognize and value all people. So this is about women's leadership.
That's right.
But it's also about the men in our life. Deutsche Bank has been an unbelievable underwriter of this. They'll have 200 of their employees, both men and women. So it's recognizing women's leadership, but working in tandem with men to make great things happen.
And that's how you have put all of this together from the start, because your goal has always been to get more women into leadership, but with men collaborating. And so last year, WJCT had a project, and we all got together, and we sodded a yard. And you would think that is such an easy thing to do. And I learned very quickly, that's a hard job. But many hands make light work. And there were about 20 or 30 of us from here at the station doing it. And with a big group of people doing it, we got it done pretty fast. So that's kind of how this plays out on February 6th. A big group does a project. And by the end of the day, something that would maybe take a full week with just a small team, you get it done by the end of the day.
Absolutely. I remember I went to almost all of the projects last year, and I think we had 21 of them.
Yeah.
And I remember going into the Hubbard House, and there was this group of people painting the hallway. And it moved me. It just moved me to know that now these women had a place where they can come that was brighter, that was cheerier. And also the connectivity between everybody's working on the projects. And we work really hard to create quality projects with the agencies, because they're the leads, but to create a great experience for everyone coming together, to know that, hey, we are all in this together.
That's right. So this is February 6th. And then, of course, Generation W is coming up in April. And that has gotten bigger every year. That is coming up on the 8th of April. This will be your fifth year doing that. I can't believe that's the fifth year in a row.
Neither can I. The fifth year of inspiration. It is shaping up really fantastically. The topics, we'll talk more about that. The people that are coming. All of it is going to create, I think, continue to provide inspiration, education, connectivity to really continue to elevate and make Jacksonville a stronger and better community. And it's also a national destination, and I'm really proud of the fact that people fly in from all over the country to join us.
You have brought in a who's who of national speakers to Generation W. It is just incredible. And of course, you're a woman who ran the WNBA. You worked at the PGA Tour. You are such an incredible leader and an inspiration to so many women. And when you began this journey with Generation W, the impetus for you, Donna, was to create a path for more women into leadership positions. When you look at the landscape in this area, do you feel like you've made some progress in that regard?
I think we've made progress. I mean, if you look at now some of what's happening inside of companies here in this, even in the city, listen, we can't take credit for it, for the fact that they have women in medicine now at Baptist, which is an amazing organization. The fact that UNF now has their Genuinely You Sheila has gone out. I mean, I went to their first meeting, 120 women who never knew each other at UNF, now coming together to help fortify one of our best educational institutions. If you look what's happening at Winn-Dixie, certainly one of our underpinning partners, they created a dialogue group at Winn-Dixie. And there's company story after story, not to even mention the independent stories and being part of the storyline. But if I could tell you, if I could share with you, you know, somebody asked me, Works, what's new this year? You know, we have a program also called WOW, which is focused on our teenage girls.
Right.
And we really focus with working with the United Way, who we love working with. They are such a great agency. And I have to tell you, I work with United Ways across the country. We have one of the best right here in Jacksonville, Florida. Michelle and her team are outstanding. And we really want young girls to understand that paying it forward helps better their lives. And so we have a special project here, working with United Way, benefiting full-service schools, packing snack packs for students who otherwise wouldn't have food on the weekends. So if you're coming, bring your teenage daughter. She can work with us. If you're a Gen Wow girl, get it out there, because we really want all of you to join us. We have some spots for some more volunteers. It's a great morning.
So get to the website right now for Generation Works. It's coming up on February 6th. Go to genwnow.com and sign up. And you can volunteer anywhere from at Hubbard House to Feeding Northeast Florida, at the Duval County Public Schools, Greenscape, Habajacks, many more projects, and learn all about Generation W, Generation Wow, Generation Works. She's Donna Orender, and it's always such an inspiration to speak with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Melissa, are you kidding? It's fantastic.
And we'll be right back with a look at the circus coming to town, The Last Time with the Elephants, our book club, and more.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, it was a rousing success on New Year's Eve in Jacksonville as the personal injury law firm Farrah and Farrah ferried hundreds of revelers home for free in cabs. Guess what? They're planning to do it again on July 4th, and this time they're going to use an app to get you home. I spoke with Eddie Farrah about what he has planned. Take a listen. Eddie Farrah, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
So your initiative, Keep Jack Safe, hugely successful on New Year's Eve. Why do you think it took off so well?
Well, we really promoted it, and it was the first year that we did this, so we wanted to make sure it was a success. And according to the information we're getting back from the taxi cab companies, we had over 750 free cab rides home. And at the beginning, earlier in the evening, we were getting phone calls from people that wanted us to take them certain places. I think maybe we should be more clear next time, make sure people understand it's a safe ride home, not from bar to bar. But it still worked out great. The 750 were all, those people all got home safely, and we're excited about it. There are a lot of people who tried to get through that could not. Again, we're working on that. Maybe we're going to have an app next year or something of that nature where people can just go directly to their iPhone and download the cab.
Oh, right. You had volunteers working the phones all night, and there were so many calls, not everybody could get through. Yeah.
Right, yeah, so many. We had seven people here answering phones. I was down here with them. They answered them till 3 in the morning. We then turned it over to an after-hour service who answers our calls in the evening, and they dispatched cabs till, I think, about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. And now you're already planning to do this again on the 4th of July. Isn't that right as well?
4th of July. We're going to do it again. We're getting geared up for that. We want to get, hopefully have our app in place by then, or some sort of app with the cab companies that allows us to dispatch those cabs more efficiently and quickly, and so people can get home.
Now,
we don't get discouraged of calling. Mm-hmm. We don't want people to say, well, I'm not going to call them because I'll never get through. We want people to have access to the what we're trying to do, and I think you know, it's going to work better next time, hopefully.
Sure. And speaking of apps, on New Year's Eve, you didn't work with ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft, which people access via an app. On New Year's Eve, they implemented big surcharges for rides yeah. home. You, on the other hand, gave people a free ride home. When you do this again on future holidays, do you anticipate working with the 21st century version of the old-fashioned taxi cab, Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, I mean, Uber, you're right. We reached out to Uber, but again, you know, they charge based on demand, and they were charging like 8 or 9 times the typical fare. The taxi cab companies did not give us any kind of break on the pricing. We're okay with that. I mean, this is their big night. I mean, they want to make as much as they can, so they charge us the going rate, but it's the taxi cab companies now that are getting into the 21st century, and apparently some of the local companies here are going to have an app that allows us to access it. We'll allow our customers to access that app to get a cab ride home.
And as a personal injury attorney, you've seen the devastation that these types of deadly wrecks can cause. So, especially on a holiday when people have had a lot to drink, this is something that avoided that.
Yeah, it did. Hopefully, not just that. I mean, it's people who get stopped for drinking and driving. I mean, we know how devastating that is and what it does to your job and everything else. But what I'd like to find out, and we're in the process of trying to get this information from the sheriff's office, is how many DUIs were issued or people were arrested on New Year's Eve of 2014 and compare that to 2015. I'm not going to say we reduce the amount, but I'm just interested in knowing if there are less DUIs this year than last year.
Well, if you get those numbers, let us know, too.
We're waiting for the sheriff's office to turn it over to us.
Eddie Farah, thanks so much for letting us get an update. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right.
Good job. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Ringling Brothers says it's responding to years of animal rights protests by phasing out elephants from the circus. In fact, Ringling's going to do so much earlier than it had planned. The greatest show on earth comes to Jacksonville this week, and it'll be the final year the elephants are part of the big event. Adam Sigalski of the local nonprofit One Protest is here with his thoughts about the big elephant announcement, and he says protesters will still be making their voices heard outside the arena. Adam, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. You know, we think it's a great start. They're getting rid of their elephants, but they need to be taken to the sanctuaries. The Ringling facility they're having in Central Florida is not a sanctuary. The elephants actually still will be living in concrete pens at night, and they can't just roam freely. And we want to point out that, you know, besides this, tigers have a real bad time in the circus too. And a lot of our messaging this year is shifting towards tigers. And, you know, Ringling makes this big announcement, like they're heroes getting rid of the elephants, but 100 years of abuse, systematic abuse, animals ripped from the wild, from their families, chained, beaten, and caged for profit to do meaningless, pointless, painful tricks. They're deflecting the facts and need to come out and really get rid of all the animals out of their shows.
So you don't think the circus should have any animal performers?
No, they don't need to. Look at Cirque du Soleil. It's a perfect example of how a show can have just human performers and do great. I mean, they're a very successful circus.
And what are your thoughts about Ringling? They settled on this case, by the way. There was a big settlement that has sort of gotten lost in this discussion. But at the same time, Ringling has backtracked. They said they were going to phase out the elephants over time. Then just last week, they came out and said, no, you know what? We're going to take the elephants out by May. They've really reversed their position. And do you feel that protest groups such as your own have won this battle? Because it seems as though your voice has really been heard on this.
I do think just from protesting 10 years in Jacksonville, I have seen ticket sales drop. And Ringling this year has dropped one of their tours from the West Coast because they're passing what's called a bullhook ban. A bullhook is a weapon. It's not a tool like Ringling likes to say it is. It's almost like a fire poker. And this is what they use for the elephants. So these bullhook bans passing in L.A. and I think Oakland has forced Ringling to get out of it. So Ringling is not making this choice. They're being forced out of the industry because people are waking up and these animals deserve to be treated better.
So declining ticket sales, not just in this area, but around the country, you think is what turned the tide?
I'm for sure it has, because a few years ago, I went to Bend, Oregon and protested. Ringling had never been to Bend, Oregon before. And we organized a protest in Bend, Oregon. The Ringling people were shocked that there was like 20 or 30 protesters in this small town they'd never been to. And guess what? They never went back again that year. So, you know, people are waking up. And I had an example a few years ago of a woman and her daughter came and talked to me after the protest because we set up a table between shows. Her daughter was crying because she saw them stun gun the elephants to get them off of the arena. And she actually came out the next day and protested with our group.
You'll be protesting the circus at the Veterans Memorial Arena this week because the elephants, this is the last year the elephants will be part of the circus.
Yes, we will start our protest. It's on Thursday at 6 o'clock in front of the arena. Keep in mind, if you want to join our protest, they're peaceful, educational. We actually like to engage circus goers. It's a dialogue between the community. We want to let them know what really happens to these animals. And like I said before, we're shifting our messages towards tigers because, you know, I've personally documented tigers going insane in these cages in the back. I have a picture of a tiger from Ringling. Almost looks like it's getting heat stroke with its tongue sticking out of its mouth, like in the sun, and they've let it sit there for hours. And I have all this in documentation photographs I've taken.
What has informed your commitment to animal rights? What is driving this for you?
To me, it's just a social injustice. You know, I think everyone has their passion in life. And just as growing up, actually 10 years ago, I was taken to my first protest against circuses. And when I started to read the literature and research it, I couldn't believe this is still happening in modern day, the way they kind of, you know, what the advertising tells us, these animals are taken care of, but they're not when you see the reality of it. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to, you know, part of making almost a life mission to get these animals out of entertainment.
Well, the circus is coming to town this Thursday. Change is coming to the circus, however, and the protesters will be there. Adam Sigalski is with the nonprofit One Protest. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. And if you want to, you can go to circusfacts.org for more information about how animals are treating the circus. Thank you.
We will speak with the ringmaster from the circus on the program later this week as well. And in a moment, today's book club. Keep listening.
Some gun control advocates believe economics can help achieve their goal.
The only thing they really understand is money.
So would divesting publicly traded gun companies from stock portfolios help the cause?
I don't think it really affects the underlying business. So over time, in a free and open market, other shareholders will come and take their place.
Whether divestiture works as a political weapon, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know?, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy the southern winter just a little bit. You bring the sunshine, I'll bring the sunscreen. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Sponsored in part by Folio Media House.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Well, finally, this hour, so much happening inside our First Coast Connect book club. Lots of books to recommend and a special event. Our book club blogger, Stacy Goldring, is here to fill us in. And I'm so excited, first of all, about your screening of The Princess Bride coming up later this month.
I am very excited, too. Just go to Blix on Facebook. And January 28th at 7 p.m. at the San Marco Bookstore, we will be discussing The Blix. The Princess Bride.
And Oblix is a book that's been made into a movie. That's a mm-hmm. word you made up,
that's
by the
right.
way.
That's right. That is very good. Very good. Very well done, Marissa. So, and if you haven't read the book, come on down. If you haven't seen the movie, come on down. If you have seen the movie, you know it's such a cult flick.
Again, that's January 28th, 7 o'clock at the San Marco Bookstore. Come on out and meet Stacy, who is just an incredible person.
A barrel of fun.
Okay, so that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, you want to talk about today's selection, which, by the way, you can get an extra copy of this at our partner, the Jacksonville Public Library. Mm-hmm. The bestseller, The Boys in the Boat.
Correct. This is a wonderful, wonderful story. And it's not only the story of a crew team who makes their way to the Olympics, the 36 Olympics in Berlin. It is a story of perseverance. It's a story of true grit. It's really the story of America and how we can make things happen. And a lot of people, after discussing this book, they think, where is that America today? You know, because a lot of people yeah. think we don't have that spunk and get up and go, but I believe we do. Uh-huh. And I think this book will really charge you up. And you're just so proud of these young men and what they can do. Also, if you liked Unbroken or Seabiscuit, Chariots
yeah,
of Fire,
sure.
all of that wrapped into one.
Really?
Yes. You actually get to meet Louis Zamperini in the film. You hear a little bit about him. You hear about Seabiscuit. So it's really
cool.
They're
all cool. in this book.
Well, they're mentioned because they're it's mentioned. All around the Olympics time.
That Olympics that
yeah.
year.
Yeah, not 36. And you know, that was the first year there was an Olympic Village.
Is that right?
Yeah, just for men.
Oh, for, just
yeah,
for the
just
guys,
for
of course.
Not just the hair graying stuff, but just for men. For, the girls had to, you know, eat at, you know, crummy places in town. But the whole idea of Olympic Village. And the sad thing is the gentleman that created the Olympic Village, he created this wonderful place where all these people could converse, be together, eat well. And then he was removed from his post because he was Jewish and he committed suicide
oh my gosh.
Afterwards. Yeah, so he never got to see the Olympics or anything like that happen.
Speaking,
he was usurped.
Oh my gosh. Well, speaking of the 36 Berlin Olympics, wasn't that the year Hitler was appalled by Jesse Owens'
yes, and, yes.
performance in the Olympics,
yeah, it
too?
Was, yeah, it was. He really, yeah, he got taken to the cleaners. And, of course, we all know what happened with the rowing team, which is, you know, Go USA.
Yeah.
I won't give it all away, but it's pretty obvious. But a little bit about rowing trivia so y'all know. Oldest Olympic sport, modern time Olympic sport. I say if you are a parent out there and you want your child involved in something fabulous, there are several rowing clubs right here in Jacksonville
That's
from
right.
which to row, as
That's
you
right.
well know.
Yes.
And the medical world claims that rowing a 2,000-meter race is the equivalent of playing back-to-back basketball games. So you got to be tough. You have to be tough.
It is a tough sport, and it's one that boys and girls can access equally well.
And old people like you and me. We're called masters, and masters can row well. This will be a film. Kenneth Branagh, you know, the guy that was married to Emma
Thompson.
Oh,
I love him. Yeah.
I can't say his last name.
Kenneth Branagh.
Him.
Yeah.
He's going to direct, so you know that will be.
Who,
you know,
has he cast anyone?
Not that we know of yet. But each of the characters in the book, each of these young boys, they each have a story to tell that everyone, with which everyone can identify. Because if you are determined, if you ever have been determined, if you want to be fired up and think, whatever you're thinking about right now that you think you can do, well, just get out of your own way because you can do it. You can start by reading this book.
Was the University of Washington crew team, were they underdogs?
Very much so. First of all, they weren't blue bloods. These were working boys. These were boys from the Depression. They had no money. They couldn't even afford to go to the Olympics. When they won their Olympic trials, the head Olympic guy said, you know what, if you can't come up with $5,000 right now to get on that boat tomorrow to go over to Berlin, we have an Ivy League team all lined up to go.
So this is like Rocky and Hoosiers.
Oh, look at you.
And
yes.
Chariots of Fire
yes.
all rolled into
yes.
one.
Yes. Okay. Oh, I loved Hoosiers.
Yeah.
Oh, that was
yeah.
such a tearjerker. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't love an underdog story?
And you know, yeah. you don't, and people that don't row can still love this book because even though it's technical, you get it.
Yeah.
You and I, Melissa, we are always in search of that perfect stroke, the perfect swing. And that's what the book is all about. It's about attaining that, you know, that ethereal thing, that perfect moment. It's a fabulous book. Just read it. It's fabulous.
Well, I always want to read anything you recommend because,
Thank
of course, you are my book spirit animal.
Well, thank
Stacey you, Stacey Goldring. Mm-hmm. And Stacey's so fabulous that the Jacksonville Public Library is our partner
Yay.
In the First Coast Connect Book Club. So if you want a copy of The Boys in the Boat and you want a free copy, you need to go to the public library
Absolutely.
Because they are our partner. Look for extra copies of The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown, the thrilling story of the 1936 University of Washington crew team and their improbable journey to the Berlin Olympics. Look for the First Coast Connect Book Club signage at the library.
That's right. And we can keep track of our rowers for 2016 Olympics, Row to Rio, hashtag Row to Rio, and we can cheer them on.
Oh, my gosh. And next month's book is?
We are going to talk about the amazing author Isabel Allende and everything that she has to offer. So anything you want to check out about Isabel, we're going to do a broad brushstrokes on this incredible, strong woman and lovely writer. Everyone should have her on their shelves.
Email your questions and comments to Stacey at bookclub@wjct.org. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Diane Reams up next as Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley face off in another Democratic presidential debate, the last one before the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. Diane will have debate, analysis, and commentary. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.